Thank you. Well, it's nice to see you all again. Some of you have been very complimentary, and I appreciate that, but I'm not so sure you're going to be complimentary again tonight, because we're going to talk a little bit about the sciences. But as Midi says, I do have a confession to make. I changed this talk at the last minute, so that some of the references I'm using are not listed in that long list. But the final version will be put on the web. Thank you very much. Now, you know who I'll always start with? Edward Wilson. Yes. Now, Wilson wrote this fabulous book, as I was telling you about yesterday, Consilience. And I said to you, I didn't quote him exactly, so I carried the book tonight. I remember, this is the first line in the book, I remember very well the time I was captured by the dream of unified learning. He calls that the Ionian enchantment. And in this book, he suggests that we should know something about ourselves. That should be the foundation. We should have some knowledge of our biology and our natures. And that should be the foundation of all knowledge. So he has his own biases, and many philosophers have attacked this idea. Mary Midgley comes to mind, Mary Midgley of Newcastle upon Tyne. But this has been a remarkable book. So from that long list, if I can recommend some of these, particularly some of these books, I would recommend Wilson. Now, why I chose him again, besides the fact that I love this man, is that he says there's a growing consilience between the physical and biological sciences. So tonight I want to speak about science and some of the glorious ideas that science has given us. And I want to use this idea of Wilson's consilience. Now, I want to focus on... Sorry. It means unity, unifying learning. Yes. I'll talk a little about it just now. I want to focus on two points, that all matter is made of atoms, and the cell is the basic unit of living matter. One has to make a choice when talking about scientific achievements and scientific milestones. There's so much to say. And because I'm a biologist, I chose this particular aspect of it. And I want to show you how it links to other ideas. So, we say the cell emerged from atoms, and then we're going to consider the levels of organization of matter, and we're going to talk about how atoms could have given rise to consciousness, to culture, society, and beyond. Now, Richard Feynman, you might have heard of, a big genius of the 20th century, a strange man in many ways. He was a physicist, a Nobel laureate who won the Nobel Prize for Physics, and he had a passion for atomic theory. And he was asked once that if in some cataclysm all of scientific knowledge were to be destroyed and only one sentence passed on to the next generation of creatures, what statement would contain the most information in the fewest words? I believe, he says, it is the atomic hypothesis that all things are made of atoms, little particles that move around in perpetual motion, attracting each other when they are a little distance apart, but repelling upon being squeezed into one another. In that one sentence, you will see there is an enormous amount of information about the world, if just a little imagination and thinking are applied. And I took this to the most simplistic level. There was a point in my life when this actually struck me. I should say, my God, my shirt's made of atoms, the desk is made of atoms, the teacher is made of atoms. What's left? What's not made of atoms? And the answer is nothing that we really know of. So, the idea of the atom is a very old one. Almost 2,400 years ago, a man by the name of Democritus in Greece, he said matter is made of indivisible units called atoms. Now in 1905, so many years later, Albert Einstein explained Brownian motion. He said, the continuous and random jiggling of pollen in water is caused by water molecules, and water molecules are made of atoms. And this, he said, even before the proton and the neutron were discovered, which are essential parts of atoms. Only the electron had been discovered in 1897 by a man by the name of J.J. Thomson. So, the model that is given to us, and it's a simplistic model because the atomic world is very complicated. I don't understand quantum theory, but I'm actually keeping this very simple. There's a positive nucleus because of the protons, and together with the protons in the nucleus are neutrons which have no charge. And then negatively charged electrons in specific orbitals moving around the nucleus. So, as I read to you last night from Stephen Hawking, atoms formed 1 million years ago after the Big Bang. And the difference between you, your cat, and a tree is a different arrangement of atoms. Now, this is the sentence I like very much from Bill Bryson's A Short History of Almost Everything. Every atom you possess has certainly passed through stars and been part of millions of organisms on its way to becoming you. I wish somebody told me that when I was a student. So we are atomic reincarnations, part Shakespeare, Buddha, Genghis Khan, and Beethoven, but not, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to tell you, the king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley. So none of you can ask me not to step on your blue suede shoes. So it takes atoms decades to be thoroughly redistributed. And upon death, atoms disassemble. Now, I've always hoped, I've always said to friends, that I hope some of mine are found on the nose of a majestic African lion in 2,000 years. Then I'll have a full frontal view of all the action in the world. But while I was thinking about this, I dug out an article from my collection by a man called George Monbiot, who writes for The Guardians. And he said in this article that he entitled it A Life with No Purpose. Darwinism implies that the only eternal life we have is in the recycling of our atoms. I find that comforting, he says. He says, Darwinian evolution tells us that we are incipient compost, assemblages of complex molecules that, for no greater purpose than to secure sources of energy against competing claims, have developed the ability to speculate. After a few score years, the molecules disaggregate and return whence they come from, period. As a gardener and ecologist, I find this oddly comforting. I like the idea of literal reincarnation. That the molecules of which I am composed will, once I have rotted, be incorporated into other organisms. He does think pleasant thoughts, doesn't he? Bits of me will be pushing through the growing tips of trees, will creep over them as caterpillars, will hunt those caterpillars as birds, and when I die, I'd like to be buried in a fashion which ensures that no part of me is wasted. Then I can claim to have been of some use after all. So that was George Monbiot. So this atomic theory has actually rocked the scientific world and has become a central part of it. Now, atoms, and physicists study atoms, make molecules. So a simple example is two atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen make water, and then the chemists study those reactions, right? And then you can get more complex atomic conformations like macromolecules, and that's what we made of. That's what the sheep are made of, macromolecules, huge assemblies of molecules, proteins, lipids, nucleic acids, long chains of carbohydrates. So those macromolecules contain largely carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen. Now, the consequences of atomic theory, one of them is chemistry, which focuses more on how the electrons which circle the atoms are either transferred or shared with other atoms to make new molecules. If we talk about how the sun functions, then the nuclei of two hydrogen atoms fuse to form helium in the sun. Now, say one hydrogen weighed 1 and the other hydrogen weighed 1, and you added 1 and 1, so it's two hydrogens. You should get 2, but you get 1.9999 something. What happened to that little bit? It got converted to the light and heat that the sun actually gives to us. Then the bomb. Of course, you don't have to say much about that. It was a chain reaction. And then quantum theory. Quantum theory, in which there is this very, very counterintuitive idea that a basic particle in the universe is also a wave. And I'm not going to go into that anymore, but quantum theory tells the scientists that the universe is built on uncertainty. That when you study these basic particles, you cannot study the velocity and position of the particle at the same time. But despite the unpredictability, it works. We've had transistor radios, we've had microchips, we've had computers, and the information revolution, X-rays, MRI scans, and I can go on. And of course, the DNA revolution. We're living now in a digital age. So, the other consequence of atomic theory, is organizational complexity. Atoms, you've got atoms that make molecules, which make macromolecules, which in turn make cells. Now, I want to actually talk about that a little, that there are links, and I'm talking about Wilson's consilience, there are links between physics, which is the study of atoms, and then when atoms combine to make molecules, the chemists become very happy. And then with chemistry, you get biochemistry, a living chemistry. That's what people like me study the macromolecules, the big ones. And then how those macromolecules then arrange themselves into cells. And each one of us is a conglomeration of trillions and trillions of cells. And from cells, you get organs, or tissue first, and then organs, and then physiological systems. The nervous system, the cardiovascular system, the digestive system. And all those systems come together and, of course, form a fully-fledged living organism. But can you see the broken line there? It gets pretty tenuous, because ultimately you get somebody with a mind. Somebody who can think. Somebody who is conscious, self-conscious and conscious of the world out there. And science, ladies and gentlemen, has for many, many generations really kept away from that. Science claimed that we study things objectively. When we get here, and even there and there, it becomes too subjective. Nobody for a long time decided, let me study what feelings or thoughts are made of. Nobody did. But that has changed, and it's changing, and I'm going to tell you about that. So, there's these links between the different areas of knowledge, and from what we know from different disciplines, as I said, physicists study the atoms, chemists study the molecules, and biochemists like me study the macromolecules and cells. And then you get the histologists, so the pathologists who look under the microscope, take a biopsy from you, look under the microscope, study tissue. Okay? And those tissues, a variety of types, can form organs, and organs form systems, and systems form organisms. Now, can you see the link between the different disciplines? This is what Wilson is talking about. We need unified learning. We need to move away or out of the box from our compartments. Okay? And George Ellis, in this wonderful... I changed my talk when I thought of George Ellis. In Nature, he wrote this wonderful article, Physics, Complexity and Causality. And he talks about a hierarchy of complexity. A hierarchy. And what is really amazing, and what I want to really tell you about, is that at each level, the whole is more than the sum of its parts. Nobody can predict that one day atoms would give rise to consciousness. Nobody would predict that. Ellis says, in the hierarchy of complexity, each level links to the one above. Chemistry links to biochemistry, to cell biology, physiology, psychology, to sociology, economics and politics. Particle physics is the foundational subject underlying, and so in some sense explaining all the others. So it all starts with the physics. In a reductionist worldview, and we'll talk about that just now, physics is all there is. The Cartesian picture of man as a machine seems to be vindicated. That's fine. So, let's move on. Now, Michael Shermer, the sort of man who started the Skeptic Society, talks of a causal net from one to the other. But what happens when you change the direction of the arrow? Well, when you change the direction of the arrow, you take someone, sorry, let me keep it there. You take someone or anything, any object, any material object, and break it down to its constituent parts, and you will get atoms. Right? Now, if you go upwards, it's not so easy. Predictions cannot be made. As Ellis says, can we nevertheless claim that the underlying physics uniquely, causally determines what happens, even if we cannot predict the outcome? To examine whether we can, contemplate what is required for this claim to be true within its proper cosmic context. The implication is, and this, ladies and gentlemen, is fascinating, the implication is that the particles existing when the cosmic background radiation was decoupling from matter in the early universe were placed precisely so as to make it inevitable that 14 billion years later human beings would exist. Nobody would have known. If any of us were in that hot universe in those early times and looking over it as a conscious being, and this is just a science fiction scenario, we would never be able to predict that these mad molecules that are just moving around randomly and clashing into each other will one day produce conscious human beings. And there was there a prediction that one day all of you are going to come and listen to me at some school? We don't know. So, these fluctuations are supposed to have been random in the early universe, which by definition means without purpose or meaning. However, such meaning did come into being. Such meaning did come into being. With this view, the higher levels in the hierarchy of complexity have autonomous causal powers that are functionally independent of lower level processes. And you know something, it is so easy to think about. But I'm doing this very simplistically because I can't think about it in any other way. If you took hydrogen and oxygen and you studied these two elements and you'll see them as elements, as atomic in nature, both gaseous, you would never have dreamed that if you combine them, you'll make water, which is a brand new substance. It has qualities. You can drink it, you can bath with it, it makes up 80% of your body. And looking at water, you would never ever say, hey, this just came from hydrogen and oxygen. That's the unpredictability of it. So, how then can you be expected to think that these atoms that float around at random actually create conscious beings? The random motion of atoms in a hot early universe led to living forms. And I've got a question mark there. Because, ladies and gentlemen, what I'm saying is that at each new level, the whole is more than the sum of its parts. Right? So, imagine now these macromolecules that we talk about, that we study as biochemists. Imagine those. They arrange themselves in a way, this makes me so excited, so if I jump onto the desk, forgive me. They arrange themselves in a way that creates a cell. And I'm saying to you, the whole is more than the sum of its parts. That cell is alive. Inanimate matter, in the form of macromolecules, arranged itself in a particular way that gave rise to a living cell. And that living cell, many, many, many millions of years later, decided it needed some company, and started talking to other cells, and then forming little cellular communities, and we got multicellularity. Stephen G. Gould spent his life marveling at this. It happened during the Cambrian period. And could you have predicted from that multicellularity that one day you're going to get organs, then you're going to get organ systems, and you're going to get human beings like us, who actually sit back and observe this. But I'm fascinated that this doesn't fascinate everybody in the world. Okay, so the consequences of this theory is organizational complexity, is reductionism. In the early 20th century, science had cast a wide causal net, linking effects to causes throughout the past and into the future, and sought to explain all complex phenomena by reducing them into their simpler component parts. Everything can be broken down to its atomic constituents. Eugene Weinberg, a Nobel laureate in physics, says, all the explanatory arrows point downward, from societies to people to organs to cells to biochemistry to chemistry and ultimately physics. He would say that because he was a physicist. Now, the interesting thing about Eugene Weinberg, he made a statement that's been quoted over and over again. He says, the more you think about the universe, the more you realize that it's meaningless. Now, I said this to George Ellis after a talk one day, and he says, oh yes, it's meaningless to him. And George Ellis put up a picture of his beautiful granddaughter, and he says, are you telling me my life's meaningless? Weinberg can go to blazes. Okay. Upon death, the atoms that make me will disassemble and probably be used to make other things. We've discussed that. And this gives rise to the first law of thermodynamics, that energy cannot be created or destroyed, but changed from one form to the other. And when I explain this to my students, I always say that if I had died, people will mourn me. I hope my family will mourn me. My friends will mourn me. It's a big loss. But when the universe does its auditing, its books, it says we've lost nothing. Because the energy that made this man is now back into the universe. His atoms have recycled into the universe. So the universe has not lost nothing. Energy has changed from one form to the other. So as George Monbiot says, it's a recycling of atoms. Now, the other consequence of this theory is emergence. In fact, each level of complexity is independent, unpredictable from the previous level, and the whole is more than the sum of its parts. And I spoke to you about a cell, right? Now, emergence and self-organization, okay, we've discussed that. Life from non-life, macromolecules make a cell. Something wholly new emerges at these higher levels of complexity. Ursula Goodenough calls it, emergence is something more from nothing but. Okay, so the other consequence of this theory, ladies and gentlemen, all that explanation I've given you is based on material things, on particles, on atoms, on cells. Things, cells you can see, organs you can see, tissues you can see, you can study them under the microscope. It's godless. All material, no spirit, no mind, no psyche, no soul. Science always claims that we deal with natural phenomena, not the supernatural. We don't have the tools to deal with the supernatural. But things have changed. Science is asking questions now about the mind. Science is asking questions now about this subjective experience. Science is even talking about the soul. That's a surprise I have for you. Right. So, this whole materialist philosophy, you can call it a godless philosophy or soulless philosophy, was actually jumped on by many, many scientists. One of them was Francis Crick, the man who discovered the structure of DNA. He wrote the astonishing hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Human Soul. When I saw the title of the book, I could have keeled over. The Scientific Search for the Human Soul. That had never, ever happened for years, for the last 200 to 300 years of science. So from the objective material world, science now turns its attention inwards to the subjective world, that of emotions, feelings, and consciousness. And if I can tell you, I do regret that I haven't put in that list Antonio Damasio, who's written some wonderful books on consciousness, Descartes' Era, Looking for Spinoza, in which he talks about the biochemistry of a feeling, the biochemistry of an emotion. And he calls these physiological processes, even consciousness, he tries to explain physiologically. And he says in his book, if you damaged one part of the brain, which is the material brain, somewhere near the brainstem, which is called the periaqueductal gray, you will be speaking to people, seemingly living your life, but you will not be conscious, self-conscious. You wouldn't be aware of what you're saying, why you're saying it. So, now Crick says, you, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will, are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and the associated molecules. He says it's all just chemistry. He says if the writer of Alice in Wonderland were around, Alice would be quoted as saying, you're nothing but a pack of neurons. Okay. In 1978, a watershed book in the history of the biological sciences was written by Richard Dawkins, his first book, The Selfish Gene. Now imagine, Dawkins says, we are just survival machines, robot vehicles, blindly programmed to preserve the selfish molecules known as genes. This is a truth that still fills me with astonishment. And it fills me with astonishment every time I think about it. So he says, so we live, we seek happiness and meaning to life, in God or material pleasures, but it's all a ploy by our very clever genes to get us to reproduce so they can spread. And then the 21st century, they say, is going to be the century of the neurosciences. And in his book, The God Part of the Brain, Matthew Alper says, science replaces our ignorance and the mysteries of the universe with understanding. Yet with all the knowledge, the problem of God looms tauntingly over the sciences. He calls it the problem of God. Stimulation of the frontal and the parietal lobes of the brain in an amygdala of monks in meditation show changes in neural activity. Religious fervor in epileptics prior to a seizure correlates with activity in parietal lobes. Mystical experiences can be explained in physiological terms. In our brains lie nature's survival mechanisms in which God is nothing but a protective lens through which humanity is programmed to view the world. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm giving you these views because that's the current thinking in the sciences. Okay? And then this man, Tom Wolfe, he wrote The Bonfire of the Vanities. You must know him. He calls Edward Wilson the new Darwin. Edward Wilson wrote a book called Sociobiology, that every human being is born not as a blank tablet waiting to be filled by experience, but as an exposed negative waiting to be slipped into developer fluid. The print is the individual's genetic history over thousands of years of evolution, and there is not much anybody can do about it. Now, Wilson ran into very serious trouble with that because he was accused of being a eugenicist. And one day at a conference, this poor mild man was just about to speak, and a group of young activists ran into the hall and took a jug of cold water and poured it over his head. And they said Wilson was so dignified about it. Stephen Jay Gould was sitting next to him. Gould didn't know what to do. He was so shocked. He says, he said that until my dying day, he has died now, but until my dying day, I will regret that I didn't stand up for Wilson. I was so shocked. And Wilson asked, what is it all about? Why are they doing this to me? And they said to him, well, it's not on in the world of left thinking. It's not on for you to say that our genes determine our behavior. That's not on. We all come as blank slates. And it's experience, our personal experiences, that make us who we are. And Wilson said, phew, nice idea, but it's better for ant communities than us. Genetics determine not only things such as temperament, role preferences, emotional responses, and levels of aggression, but also many of our most revered moral choices, which are not choices at all in any free will sense, but tendencies imprinted in the hypothalamus and limbic region of the brain. So this business about us not having free will is another debate, and that's for another day. Now, Steven Pinker wrote these two books, the Blank Slate and How the Mind Works, and he's written many others. He's becoming more and more difficult to understand. But I guess I read this to my students. I'm a warden and a resident, and I'm encouraging my students to read. And I was telling them about Pinker and his theories of brain and mind. Pinker is a materialist who believes that the brain secretes the mind like the pancreas secretes insulin. So mind is nothing fascinating. It's just a side product of all the neuronal activity that goes on in your brain. So now, he said, imagine an advanced people from another galaxy, two people were sent to come and see what's going on in that little blue spot out there in the remotest part of the Milky Way galaxy. And those people land here and they watch us for a while and then they go back to report to their boss. And they tell their boss this astonishing thing. They're made out of meat. Meat! There's no doubt about it. We picked several from different parts of the planet, took them aboard our vessels, probed them all the way through. They completely meat. So he says, that's impossible. What about the radio signals? The messages to the stars. They use the radio waves to talk, but the signals don't come from them. The signals come from machines. So who made the machines? That's who we want to contact. They made the machines. That's what I'm trying to tell you. Meat made the machines. That's ridiculous. How can meat make a machine? You're asking me to believe in sentient meat. I'm not asking you. I'm telling you, these creatures are the only sentient race in the sector, and they're made out of meat. So then he asks, no brain? Oh, there's a brain, all right. It's just that the brain is made out of meat. So what does the thinking? You're not understanding, are you? The brain does the thinking, the meat. So then the boss says, thinking meat. You're asking me to believe in thinking meat. Yes, thinking meat, conscious meat, loving meat, dreaming meat. The meat is the whole deal. Are you getting the picture? So this materialism and physicalism I've been thinking about for many, many years. And it struck me one day that it does fill me with awe. The ideas fill me with awe. I marvel at them. And I'm sure so many others do. And that feeling of awe, that feeling of wonder, is that not a spiritual feeling? Why cannot it be? Consider Paul Davies. Paul Davies, who's still waiting for a signal from another galaxy. He's a physicist who says science alerted him to the beauty and wonder of the universe far more than his religious upbringing. And I can actually empathize with that. But now, Shermer, who's a skeptic, says, what place for God in all these explanations? Right, think about it, and it fills you with awe and wonder, and that's your spiritual experience. Is this the bridge we're looking for between religion and science, or spirituality and science? Does science bring an austerity to reality? Right. Now, Dawkins... Now, I want to tell you something. I spoke to Philip Tobias a few months before he died. You all know Professor Philip Tobias. one of our icons. He was very, very happy with me. Let's have a sip. Because I had written the review of his second book, Tobias in Conversation. It was done in conversational style with somebody called Dugard and somebody with an unpronounceable name. And apparently it didn't have a very good review from an American reviewer. And then for some reason I was asked to review it, and I reviewed it, and then we had a conversation on the phone, and he said, the next time you're in Joburg, we're going to have chocolate cake and tea. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately that never happened. I was a great admirer of Philip Tobias. But he said to me during that last conversation, he said, I went to visit Richard Dawkins. And I said to Richard Dawkins, the way you go on about your ideas, you bring an austerity to the universe. You demystify. You want to leave no mystery. And Dawkins says, I disagree with you, Professor Tobias. Read my Unweaving the Rainbow. Ever since Isaac Newton, I think somebody mentioned it to me just now, ever since Isaac Newton sort of found out what made the colors of the rainbow, does it in any way undermine the beauty of the rainbow? I don't think so. The problem is the way science is taught, and the problem is the way the scientists currently are behaving. People sort of feel that I don't want to be involved in that science. But now, Shermer's question, what place for God in all this materialist philosophy? And there's a man by the name of Kaufman, I think his name is Gerald. I read a review of his book once by Sean Duvall in the Mail and Guardian, and then went on and bought the book. And he said, perhaps in this 21st century, we need a new way of thinking about God. Perhaps the good daddy in the sky, who's transcendental and outside the universe, wherever outside the universe, whatever that means, because scientists say there's no outside, who's looking over every flea and every dewdrop, is not the God, or cannot be the God of the 21st century. I think it was Spinoza who actually questioned that. And he spoke of an immanent God, a God that permeates the entire universe and is not in any way transcendental. But Kaufman, in his wonderful book, Reinventing the Sacred, says, let's naturalize the deity. These things that I explained to you, the various levels of organization. Can God be our chosen name for the ceaseless creativity in the natural universe, biosphere, and human cultures? If reductionism leaves us as nothing but particles in motion, then only brute facts exist in reality. But the agency that arises with life brings value, meaning, and action into the universe. So the blind forces of physics. Now this is Raymond Tallis, who's a neuroscientist at Manchester University, who's always fighting with Dawkins and Co. And he says they don't know what they're talking about. They're just scientific fundamentalists. He says, answer this. The blind forces of physics gave rise to purposeful, thinking, meaningful, moral, and conscious beings who in turn marvel at the blind forces of physics. How do you explain that? That if there's no purpose and meaning in this universe, how do you explain that? And that's a huge challenge. Okay. Now, the awe and wonder part, I just put in this slide because when I read this, I was so fascinated. Your atoms hold you together by energy. Now, it's like a bomb. If you release those atoms through a chain reaction, you get a huge explosion because that energy is released in one go. Now imagine if one of us, our energy that is holding us together, all these atoms holding us together, forming cells, was suddenly released and I was disaggregated completely into my atoms. The nature of the explosion and the energy released would probably burn the whole of the Western Cape. Now, if they all release suddenly and completely, the energy that is released is described by E is equal to mc squared. This was a brilliant, brilliant thing by Albert Einstein's famous equation. Because as I stand, I am matter, but there's two sides to this coin. There's matter and it represents energy. So, the heat that would be released from me is actually that of the sun originally being returned to the atmosphere. And Feynman says the world looks different after studying science. Trees are made of atoms in the air, primarily. When they are burned, they go back to air, and in the flaming heat that is released is the flaming heat of the sun, which was originally bound in to convert the air into the tree. So sunlight, that energy, took all these atoms and arranged them in such a way that it made a tree. So that energy belongs to the sun. So each one of us is made from the energy of the sun. We are actually stardust. And this is where I sometimes put my books down and feel sad when I think of what a boring school life and university life I had when it came to the teaching of science. I mean, I had a lecturer, I met him 2 years ago, a chemistry lecturer. He hadn't changed, he was still just as slow as he was all those years ago. And he's just standing and he says, the electrons move around the nucleus of the atom in its own orbit. For God's sake, when he spoke of oxidation, which is a loss of an electron from an atom, right? When he spoke of reduction, reduction is the attraction of atoms towards an atom. Now oxygen, the oxygen that we breathe, is an oxidizing agent. That means it will take electrons from something else and fill its own orbital and become reduced. So it oxidizes glucose, breaks it down and releases glucose's energy so we can function, right? But at the same time, it takes glucose's electrons and becomes reduced. Your damn life depends on it. Why did they ever tell me that? I can't believe it. And when I stand before a class, when I used to teach big classes, I used to tell them, suddenly they used to pop up and say, have you ever thought about it? No, I haven't. Because it was never taught to them that it's so exciting. It's so exciting. Okay, so this organizational complexity we spoke about, and then we went and talked about the cell. And I just want to tell you, look at the cell. It's alive. I mean, the first cell appeared in this universe almost 4 billion years ago. Nobody predicted that one day cells will form communities and form living organisms. And if you look inside the cell, something that you can't even see, look at the number of reactions that are taking place to keep itself alive and to keep us alive, because cells make us. And 2 billion years ago, a bacterium entered the cell. And that bacterium decided, hey, this is a nice place to reside in. But the cell said, get out. And the bacterium said, I'll work for you. Right? I'll work for you. I'll be your powerhouse. Inside me, you can send your glucose to me. I will make sure that it's oxidized, broken down, its energy released. You can make ATP, and I'll send the ATP back to the cell. And you can function. ATP is our energy currency. The idea worked. The bacterium stayed and is now known as the mitochondria, which is an integral part of the cell. But it was originally a bacterium. I mean, these are the fascinating things that science teaches us. And then I was telling you that when I teach my students, I say to my students, now imagine that this whole theory of how a cell takes in glucose and breaks it down step by step through the oxygen that we breathe in, and then converts that energy into a currency that we could use as energy in the cell. So the glucose itself is energy, but we can't use it. So if I had to explain it another way, and I'm doing this like I do to my students, please forgive me, is if I gave you $1,000, and said, could you bring me a Coke? I'm very thirsty. You could go to Pick and Pay and say, oh, you can buy many Cokes, but you've got the wrong currency. You need to convert it to rands and come back here. That's what the cell is doing. It's taking dollars and converting it to rands, to put it in, you know, for want of putting it any other way. But this whole thing, you know, all happens on the surface of this mitochondrion, which was an intruder in the cell. Right? And eventually, through all these processes, you get this thing called ATP. And so when I do this, my muscle ATP breaks. So it allows me to do this, but gets converted to ADP. And then this whole process starts again, and more ATP is made from ADP and inorganic phosphate. Marvelous. And one day when I was teaching this, I must share this with you, I suddenly stopped and asked my students, do you marvel at this? This was worked out by one man called Mitchell in 1959. He won the Nobel Prize for it. Do you marvel at this? And then in that little group, there happened to be 5 or 6 Muslim students. And I looked at them and I said, you know something, I must tell you this, that every time I go to mosque on a Friday, and then I greet the Imam after the prayer, and the Imam said, he called me doctor, the Imam used to call me doctor, he said, doctor, one day you must come forward. What he actually meant is, usually on a Friday congregational prayer, which is the Muslim Sabbath, the Imam gives a lecture about how we should live, about morality, about ethics. And when he said to me, you should come forward, what he actually meant was, you must come and give us a talk one day. And I always laughed about it, you know, sort of left the mosque. And I said to my students, what if I go and talk to the congregation about how a mitochondria makes energy? And there's evidence for it. And look at this marvelous thing that's happening in each one of ourselves. What would happen? How would it go down with the congregation? Tell them something new and something true and something beautiful and something marvelous. The student said to me, Prof, don't do it. Don't think about it. That's the state of the world. That's why there's a conflict between science and religion. Now, could the beauty revealed by science in so many spheres be the bridge to spirituality? Can we find a conciliatory position? Because I don't believe that they perpetually in conflict, like I said at the beginning of my lectures yesterday. Can there be a coexistence of the two? Not combination, but a coexistence. And that takes me to this marvelous book, The Sacred Depths of Nature, by Ursula Goodenough. Ursula Goodenough is a scientist, a biologist at the University of Washington. And she says that as a child in school, they went on an excursion, and she had a terrible experience lying there out in the open on a very starry night, looking up at the stars. And she broke down, she cried. It was some kind of panic attack. She said, my God, this universe is so, so vast. And it goes on as if it lasted forever. And I'm so small. And I will die in a few decades. And what's the purpose of all this life? And she suddenly was overwhelmed by a feeling of meaninglessness. Now, she had many friends in her hometown, and she used to visit them, and many of them were in the church choir. And she had studied zoology at the University of Washington. And whenever she visited her hometown, she went to the church, and she joined her friends in the choir. Right? And she used to look around at her friends singing in the choir, and wonder, my God, they look so happy. They look so content. They look as if they're living with death certainty. And then she thought to herself, why don't I feel like that? And then it struck her that, you know what it is? They are happy about the truth of a scripture that's 2,000 years old. But so much has happened since those 2,000 years. I have been privileged to have been exposed to things that happened in the last 400 years, and that's biology, the biological sciences. And she says, when she studies the biological sciences, she feels the same level of spirituality and happiness that her friends felt. And she said, why can't the new narrative be incorporated with the old? My friend Augustine should, whenever he gives a speak talk, he also says that kind of thing. So, she wrote this book for her dad. He was obsessed with the need to understand why people are religious. His undergraduate course on the psychology of religion, he used to say, I do not believe in God. His last book said, I still pray devoutly, and when I do, I forget my qualifications and quibbles, and call upon Jesus, and he comes to me. Perhaps the conventional idea of a personal God, a tinkerer in the sky, is hopelessly inadequate, says Paul Tillich, and this was quoted by Karen Armstrong. But the outright rejection of a deity leaves humanity with anxiety. You know, Julian Barnes wrote in his book, Nothing to be Frightened of, I don't believe in God, but I miss him. That was his opening line. And Barnes, like we have book clubs today, Barnes spoke about old philosophers and writers like Emile Zola, who had death clubs, not book clubs. They used to gather on Saturday mornings to discuss mortality. Why do we have to die? And he said this whole thing about dying in Nothing to be Frightened of is a topic that has been being discussed for centuries. With the advent of science, Pascal imagined the full horror of a godless world, empty of meaning, significance, and alien, a sense of desolation. Karen Armstrong says somewhere that with the advent of science in the 17th and 18th centuries, people saw a mechanistic world and they suddenly missed the idea of God like a hole in the head. So in this brave new world, belief in God could only be a matter of personal choice. So, Ursula Goodenough asks, why is there anything at all rather than nothing? Where did the laws of physics come from? Why does the universe seem so strange? Why are people religious? Why am I not religious? After 12 years in church choir, the global tradition needs to be, with a shared worldview, a culture-independent, globally accepted consensus of how things are. And she seeks a scientific narrative, and she wrote this book. Now, in this book, if I may just read a passage or two to you, if you don't mind, it's one of my favorite passages. This book is divided into several chapters in which she takes one scientific, biological idea, like, say, evolution, or how a cell makes protein. And she describes it scientifically, and then at the end she writes a little reflection of the passage. Absolutely beautiful. But she says, any global tradition needs to begin with a shared worldview, a culture-independent, globally accepted consensus as to how things are. From my perspective, this part is easy. How things are is, well, how things are. Our scientific account of nature, an account that can be called the epic of evolution, the Big Bang, the formation of stars and planets, the origin and evolution of life on this planet, the advent of human consciousness, and the resultant evolution of cultures. This is the story, the one story that has the potential to unite us because it happens to be true. Now, she says something extremely interesting in the second paragraph. She says, but that potential can be realized under only one condition. A cosmology works as a religious cosmology only if it resonates, only if it makes the listener feel religious. To be sure, the beauty of nature, sunsets, woodlands, fireflies, has elicited religious emotions throughout the ages. We are moved to awe and wonder at the grandeur, the poetry, the richness of natural beauty. It fills us with joy and thanksgiving. Our response to accounts of the workings of nature, how do these things work? We love the sight of the sea on a hot day, but how did the sea come about is what we don't ask. So our response to accounts of the workings of nature, on the other hand, is decidedly less positive. The scientific version of how things are and how they came to be is much more likely at first encounter to elicit alienation, enemy, nihilism, responses that offer little promise for motivating our allegiance or moral orientation. And I would recommend this book. I think it's got some wonderful ideas. And there's two main areas of contention, the origin of the universe and, of course, the theory of evolution, which I'd like to talk about a little tomorrow. And then I want to talk about Islam, but you'll have to bear with me. I want to talk about my personal experiences and how Islam now relates to science, and then a little bit about Christianity and Judaism. I think their relationship with science is an easier one, and there's not very much to say about it, but in Islam it's a complex issue, and we'll do that tomorrow. Thank you very much.
May I ask you something?
Yes, please.
Who reads that, what's the name now?
Yes.
Have you read her book on Islam?
Yes.
What did you think of it?
I think Karen Armstrong is a very, very... Okay. Karen Armstrong is... Oh, the question is, what do I think of Karen Armstrong's book on Islam? Now, I want to say something about Karen Armstrong. Karen Armstrong, when things get tough for the Muslims in the UK, Karen Armstrong is called upon to represent them. Karen Armstrong has studied Islam in very much detail. She's very balanced, very fair. She doesn't like the emphasis on what she calls Islamic fundamentalism, because she says all religions have an aspect of fundamentalism to them. And she writes these brilliant books, the Search for God, The Battle for God, Muhammad. She has researched Muhammad, and yes, it's a very, very different picture of Muhammad to what we're getting from the West. And then she wrote her autobiography, The Spiral Staircase, which is, you know, if I can stand here and say, you must read this and you must read that, because these books excite me. But read it if you like.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Have I offended you in any way?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. ADP, when it combines with P, inorganic phosphate, makes ATP. ADP is adenosine diphosphate, and add another P or phosphate to it, you get ATP, adenosine triphosphate. Now, when you exercise, well, now you nodded at me. A lot of you are able to do that because you have ATP, which you got from glucose, actually, and it was converted. But now you used that ATP to nod because your muscles contracted. So your ATP broke into ADP plus P. So now you're going to have to make more ATP from ADP. Right?